Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The 2006-2007 schedule of music, dance, opera, and theatrical events at Krannert Center is available by contacting the Krannert Center ticket office or visiting krannertcenter.com.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inch. Thanks for tuning in today. This morning, both hours of Focus 580 come from the archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that today we'll not be taking your calls. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking a bit about the work of the American philosopher and psychologist William James. Now, among the things that interested James was religious experience, and he said that maybe the best way to understand the religious impulse, the religious spirit in human beings, was to look at some of the most extreme forms of religious expression. And so our guest for this hour of Focus 580, writer J.C. Holman, set out to try to do that. And over the course of some time, spent time talking with Druids and Satanists and UFO cultists and Wiccans and a range of people that, fairly enough, I think should be said, occupy some of the religious fringe here in the United States. And he learned some interesting things. And among the things he learned, perhaps, was that the people he met, while all very different, did indeed have one thing in common, and that was that their beliefs brought meaning and happiness to their lives. He has recorded this in his book, The Devil is a Gentleman, Exploring America's Religious Fringe. And that book is published by Random House. It's out fairly recently, so you can seek it out in the bookstore, and it's an interesting read. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest, J.C. Holman. He's a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop and the writing seminars at Johns Hopkins. He has published fiction and nonfiction in a number of national magazines, and he is currently serving as the Bannister Writer-in-Residence at Sweetbriar College. Mr. Holman, hello.
Hi there. How you doing?
I'm good. I'm doing well. Thanks. And yourself?
Very good.
Well, it's I know not a very interesting question to start with, but I guess one of the best ways I could start is just to ask flat out, what started you on this project?
I think I'm a writer who's always sort of trusted his curiosity, and I'd always had kind of an interest in different kinds of religious expression, At one point, after I finished my first book, I was just kind of looking around on the internet and found this UFO group that had predicted that the Space Brothers would land in 2001. And as it happened, it was December of 2001. And so what I did is I arranged to go to their first meeting of 2002. I didn't have a book at this point. I was just sort of following my curiosity. I went out there, and this was in San Diego. There was the curious juxtaposition of the one UFO called the group I was looking at with Heaven's Gate, which is probably the more famous San Diego UFO cult, where the 39 members all killed themselves a number of years ago. And so I went out there to sort of look at both of these UFO groups, the ones who had killed themselves and then the ones whose prophecy had just failed. And while I was out there, I had the idea that maybe these two groups expressed something basic about the thinking of William James. And so I got the book, read it again, his book, Varieties of Religious Experience, read that again, and then wrote up what I'd experienced with those two groups and was basically on my way with this book.
Yeah. It's the difference between the two groups, while in a sense they would seem to be similar, maybe one of the big differences is on the one hand we had the group of people who believed so deeply in this idea that aliens were going to come and were going to take them away to a better place that they committed suicide. The other group, I think the big thing at the time that you met them, the thing that they were wrestling with, trying to figure out was the fact that the prophecy of the person who had founded it, that that aliens would arrive in 2001 and bring this new spiritual age to the earth, it didn't happen. So it seemed that at this point where you met them, and I think this was in 2002, that they were really wrestling with this question, well, what does it mean that the aliens never arrived.
Right. Yeah, they that was the sort of interesting part. That group, now all the groups that I looked at wound up expressing something about James's thinking. And the two groups, the Heaven's Gate and the Unarians, the other group, they sort of illustrated the difference between what James called the right side of religion's account and the wrong side of religion's account, meaning that that religion could make some very bad things happen in the world, the Inquisition, the Crusades, or whatever, but also we're responsible for mustering the best parts of the human spirit, and so in Heaven's Gate and Unarius, you had that basic split, you know, that Heaven's Gate's the wrong side of the religion's account, and the Unarians are the right side in that they had managed to shape a pretty thriving little community there. As wacky as the belief was, it worked for them. It had cash value in James's terms, meaning it had efficacy as an idea, and so, you know, it was a little sad, you know, to sort of watch them struggling with the failure of the prophecy and how they were going to go about remaining on the right side of religion's account in the wake of that.
Well, that, I think, there again, the question, I think, when you read that particular section, the question you ask yourself as a reader is, why are these people still together? Why are they still doing it? Why are they still Unarians, given that the fundamental idea that being that the aliens were going to come, it didn't happen. Why is it they just didn't give up and go on and do something else?
Well, I think that sort of goes to the heart of what religion is really about, you know. And for James, you know, the idea of what it was really about had to do with its effects, and this sort of goes to the heart of Jamesian thinking and his pragmatic truth. He eventually becomes the founder of the philosophy known as pragmatism, and he would argue that we should look at these ideas and measure their efficacy by the effect that they had. Now, these ideas for them, they just worked. They made them happy people. They made life seem worth living to those people, and so, of course, they wanted it to go on, and I think for James anyway, that's the essence of religion, that you can evaluate religion not based on whether the basic tenets of the belief are based in fact. Like, is there a Christian God, or are there space brothers, or whatever? Those are irresolvable questions. But you can evaluate religion by measuring the effect that those beliefs have on real, actual lives.
Yeah, he was interested in what needs religion satisfied.
Right. Yeah. I mean, to some extent, you know, he didn't want to believe that people would believe whatever they needed to believe, but he did believe that there were a variety of people, a variety of personality types, and therefore that explains why there was a variety of religions. It seems self-evident when you say it like that, but when you think about religion today, what you see is a lot of people who, and I'm speaking of religion not on the fringe, of Christianity, Islam, and others who essentially would argue that the world would be better off if it was all Christian or all Muslim or whatever. And so that idea that we can value a variety of religions is not something that's actually celebrated in practice, even though it seems self-evident in a Jamesian context. And that's what James wanted to get at. You know, he wanted to figure out how we could celebrate having a variety of religions. And he's doing that looking at the fringe in the 19th century, and so that was sort of the task that I took for myself, looking at religions that emerged in the 20th century, a lot of them seeming to borrow from James's thinking.
Mm-hmm. So overall, I realize this is maybe the kind of thing that we should save for the end, but I guess overall, your bottom line conclusion, if you did ask a question, something like, what all these people are different, what they believe is different, their practices are different. If you ask the question, what was it that they all had in common, that it sounds as if it would be, as I said in the little introduction, that even though their beliefs were all different, that the thing that they had in common was that those beliefs did indeed bring meaning and happiness and satisfaction to their life. It actually it worked for them, so that somebody else with a different set of beliefs might want to marginalize these people. But the fact of the matter is that if you asked them and looked at how they were living their lives, they would probably say they were doing just fine, and that their beliefs were part of what enabled them to be doing just fine.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think you can see these kinds of battles going on. If you look at something like Scientology, which is one of the groups that I write about, and the big fracas that came about with Tom Cruise, mid last year. You sort of look at it and you hear fragments of different parts of Scientological belief, and you think, well, how can he believe that? But yet, he's pretty clearly happy about it. How do you make sense of that? And that was what James wanted to get at. I mean, that's not the entirety of the account, right? Mm-hmm. There is that wrong side of religion's account. If you look at fringe groups, you almost invariably have to talk about, what is a cult? At some point, it's not a word that sociologists particularly like to use because it's so stigmatized. And I think I looked at the two UFO groups because it sort of let me address that right at the beginning. The religion where everyone winds up dying and the religion that is thriving. And I think that's an important part of it as well. Religions which devalue individuality or devalue creativity, for example, those are not the ones that James wants to say are on the right side of religion's account. But yet there is this other side of the account that is what he wants to talk about, and it's not something that you see talked a lot about today, in the media anyway, and that's what I kind of wanted to get at, too.
Our guest is J.C. Holman. He's a writer. He is currently writer-in-residence, currently serving as Bannister writer-in-residence at Sweetbriar College. He's a graduate of the Iowa Writers Workshop. His first book was The Chess Artist, which is about people who were obsessed with chess. It was a well-received book. He's written fiction and nonfiction for a number of national magazines. And this book here, his most recent, is titled The Devil is a Gentleman, Exploring America's Religious Fringe. It's published by Random House. Maybe you could explain the title. Where does that line come from?
Well, it's originally a Shelley quote, James invokes it at one point in his work. It's actually when he's talking about God, and he's talking about the idea that God needs to be an effective idea, and he's sort of describing the God of Christianity as being too majestic and remote to make an actual difference in the world. And he says that God needs to be more. He needs to get dirty. He needs to come down and do things on in the world if we're gonna believe in him. So he's looking at different kinds of gods and the ones that people believe in, and he's and the ones that where people can see the God acting in the world are the ones that people choose to believe in, because that's the idea that has value for them. And so at one point he says, the Prince of Darkness may be a gentleman, as we are told he is, but whatever the God in earth and heaven is, he can surely be no gentleman. And so I'm kind of borrowing from that quote a little bit and twisting it a little bit for a little irony value, I guess.
Well, we have a caller here from Indiana. Let's talk with them right here on our line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Two things. First thing is sort of an anecdote or fact. One thing, these organizations, if you cover a lot of them other than just the Wicca people, for example, they sometimes keep important philosophical tracts in print, such as Plotinus. There's a group I'm familiar with that has translated rather recently, actually, in terms of the first translations of Plotinus. Of course, it's their aspect is, the religious stuff about being and everything. But I always thought that was interesting, that a lot of them keep those things going, and every once in a while people go back and start studying some of those earlier people and become fashionable, then they recede. The second thing is, I wonder if you got into any of the fraternal groups that are organized around these kind of religious views. I can't give you any names of them. I've come across some of the people, And I remember one fellow had a tome that must have been 4 inches thick, and it was about the system of metaphysics, for example, written by, I think, a fellow out of Chicago a long time ago, the turn of the century. And I got involved in some of these groups, and their religious fervor is just as strong as, you know, the Christian fundamentalists as far as that goes. I was wondering if you come across any of them. Thanks a lot, and I hope you make your money today.
All right.
I just did mine a few not too long ago on the internet.
Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot.
Well, to answer the second question, I did look into a few of the fraternal orders, but only briefly. I limited myself to most of those go back to the 19th century, and I think that the ones I was looking at were religions that had pretty clearly emerged in the 20th century or had a strong 20th century component, and as well had a strong American component. As to his first question, I did find evidence that at least some of these religions are borrowing from older philosophies or even updating them. I'm not quite sure about them sort of keeping them in their original form, but I did definitely see traces of older philosophies, particularly like Swedenborg. We've already been talking about the UFO groups. Emanuel Swedenborg, who actually has an entire church and religion dedicated to him, the New Church. They have a cathedral outside of Philadelphia. But Swedenborg wrote a book about traveling to other planets. It was supposedly nonfiction too, that traveling to other planets of the solar system and the universe and encountering the people there and discovering that they're Christians too. So he is a philosopher whose some of his ideas sort of are used as formative material for modern UFO groups.
All right. Well, again, other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, I'd like to go on and maybe talk a little bit about some of the other people that you met. We talked a little bit about the Unarians, these people in the San Diego area, mm-hmm. who had this, the movement was started by a woman that had predicted that aliens would come to the Earth in 2001, and it would be the beginning of a new age for the Earth and so forth. You also visited with some Druids that were living in Northern California.
Right.
I guess there the thing that interests me is that when you talk about contemporary or modern Druids, I mean, we know that the Druids existed there with the ancient Celtic priesthood and not a lot had been written about them. And at the same time, I guess it was my understanding that nobody really knows what they believed or what their practice was. So in
right,
a sense,
right.
modern Druidism is something that's completely made up. I mean, one has to ask, well, what exactly is it? Is it an ancient religion? Is it a modern religion? You know, what is it?
Right. I mean, I think that's in part why I could include it in my book, saying it's a recent invention. When religions are emerging, well, all religions really like to be able to hearken back to stuff that's very old. It gives it a value, and when what you see after the Inquisition is Europeans saying, you know what, maybe this Christianity thing isn't so hot after all, and so they're looking around for different kinds of religious inspiration. So what they go to is pre-Christian Europe, and unfortunately, all that's known about the religion of pre-Christian Europe comes from the Romans who are invading. And so all we know about the Druids comes from them, because the Druids didn't write anything down. They memorized everything. They considered knowledge to be sacred and valuable, and writing it down would make it vulnerable. Other people could just read it. And so they didn't write anything down. So all we know about them is secondhand stuff. And after the Inquisition, again, when people are beginning to look at all this, they look at everything that's pre-Christian and essentially equate it. Everything, there's no archaeological methodology there. So everything that's pre-Christian in Europe is the same thing. So Druids are associated with everything they knew. So Stonehenge, for example, even though it predates what we know about the Druids by several thousand years, becomes the Druid circles. And that's not the case, but that's sort of what happened. happens when Druidry reemerges around the 18th century, and it gets tied in, you know, with the emergence of Freemasonry eventually, and then eventually in the 20th century gets tied into neo-paganism. Mm-hmm. So the Druids that I wound up looking at are neo-pagans. And as such, are very American, because neo-paganism, while it starts off as British, eventually makes the leap to the U.S., and now the U.S. is sort of home to neo-paganism.
Well, that invites a question about any of these groups, about is there something about them, do you think, that is distinctly American?
You know, that's sort of a big question that I've gotten before, and I'm not quite sure how to answer it, except in the sense that, you know, to note that America is and always has been a very religious country. It's a country that was founded at least in part on religious variety. You know, you have a variety of sects who are coming to the New World precisely because they can practice their religion there and they can't in Europe. What of that has been passed down? I don't know. America is not as secular as Europe. It's not as secular as Japan. You know, for all of Ann Coulter's ranting about the godless left, it's actually a lot of Americans are very, very religious and does that say something about us as Americans? I don't know. I think empirically, you just have to look at it and you have to say, well, yes, this is so, and that probably explains William James's interest in it.
Well, let's talk with someone in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hey. Mm-hmm. I was a religious studies student myself at the University of Tennessee some years ago, and was particularly interested in the origins of the Christian church. And studied under a man named Dungan, who really tried to bring home how the religion itself had changed. And although he never actually said anything outright to this effect, it really gave the hint that there were a lot of political influences the chopping away so many of the Gospels until we just had the four left. All in an interest of really trying to establish the papal succession and the authority in the church. On a parallel, I was aware of Scientology some 20 years ago and read a book by his son, or co-written by his son, that really kind of brought up a lot of the more negative and the negative side of the institution of Scientology. And of course, popular discussions on other religions like Mormonism, the same kind of thing comes up of how its origins are really questionable. And I wonder, as a scholar, if you as I did have a great amount of respect for the people who are practitioners or proponents of a religion, how you reconcile the hypocrisy of the institution that you either suspect or are convinced are there with the fact that there are people that still truly identify with this religion, and how you manage to reconcile this in yourself as a scholar.
Well, thanks for bringing that up. You brought up a lot of interesting points there, and the link between Scientology and early Christianity is actually one that I've thought about a lot. I think, you know, Scientology is probably the most successful new religious movement of the 20th century, and you can see them at this point, and I depicted this in my book. I'm a literary writer, really, so I want to portray some of these religious experiences in a way that sort of shows you maybe, you know, what's attractive about them and what's going on with them. So I wouldn't call myself a scholar, and I'm not posing hypotheses that I'm attempting to prove. I'm telling you stories and narratives about them that maybe show these things. But one of the things I tried to portray in Scientology was the way in which that they're now attempting to kind of go mainstream. You know, that they start off with a pretty unusual set of ideas and beliefs, and now that that Hubbard has died, and that's 20 years ago now, they're beginning the effort to become mainstream and to consolidate some of the things. And I think you can see an echoes of that, or in that you can see echoes of what's going on with Christianity as Christianity begins to resolve itself over the years. And this is characteristic of religion, I think. You know, I think if you look at more recent examples, Christian Science or Mormonism, that you always start out with the vision of someone who strikes us as being pretty peculiar. If it's Mary Baker Eddy or Joseph Smith or L. Ron Hubbard, they all are claiming to have these visions and they pass down these works and then a religion organizes around them. And then what happens later, and to sort of address the, so I guess what I'm saying is, yes, you know, everything, those links you're making, they're definitely in line with what I observe and portray in the book. As to whether, you know, this becomes hypocritical later on, yeah, probably. I think that you know, and to go back to William James was very suspicious of what happens to religion once it becomes an institution. You know, he didn't like the idea of religious institution at all, and he contrasted this with religious experience. Once a religion becomes an institution, it stops having that immediate effect for its laity. And I think that too is characteristic of religion. You know, you have the Catholicism of theologians, and then you have the Catholicism of the lay people, and they're very different from one another, and that too. I mean, once you get into the institutionalized side of religion, that's another characteristic of religion as a whole. But again, you know, what I'm looking at is the smaller religions that maybe aren't to that point yet, but in the case of Scientology, yes, they were right at that moment when they were beginning to become an institution and more a business than a religion, and that's kind of the disturbing part of it. Maybe contrast that with Wicca, I think, which is also a very fast growing religion. But seems to be going about it in a very different way. They seem aware of this whole issue, that if they become an institution, they will become something that they didn't want to be part of in the first place.
Well, most of the Wiccans that I've met, I actually studied a coven that's formed in East Tennessee, and most of the Wiccans that I've met are, by their very nature, anti-institutional. They're typically solitary Wiccans that sort of grudgingly associated themselves with this coven and are very reluctant to give more than the barest allegiance at all.
Right. Yeah, I think you know what I went to is I went to a summer solstice celebration in Seattle, and then I went to the national meeting of the Covenant of the Goddess, which is an organized federation of witch covens, and which, you know, strikes us as very strange if you're not a neo-pagan yourself. And yet, you know, what I found there was a bunch of people who wanted to value individuality, they wanted to value creativity, and they were trying to become an organized entity without suffering the downsides of institutionalization or organization. And in that, Wicca was embodying something very basic to William James. They were trying to bring about a truly pluralistic system where you could have Wiccans of an atheist tradition, Wiccans of a monotheistic or duotheistic or a polytheistic tradition, all making house together, as James would have put it, all you know, living together and having the benefits of organization without suffering the downside of institutionalization.
Thank you very much.
Well,
sure, thanks
for the call.
A lot for the question.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here of this hour of focus. Our guest is J.C. Hallman. He is a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop and writing seminars at Johns Hopkins. He's published fiction and nonfiction in a number of national magazines, including GQ. His first book was The Chess Artist, about people who are very, very passionately involved in playing chess. He is currently serving as Bannister Writer-in-Residence at Sweetbriar College, and he's the author of this book that's titled The Devil is a Gentleman, Exploring America's Religious Fringe, published by Random House, which is in part an exploration of the work of William James, the American psychologist and philosopher, who, among other things, was very much interested in religious experience, and also an account of his, that is J.C. Hallman's time spent with people who are in a variety of non-traditional kind of religious groups, people like Wiccans and Druids and Satanists and people who believe aliens will come to the earth sometime soon. All of that's in the book, and you can look for it in the bookstore. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I can't imagine some of the people, at least, that you talk to looking at that subtitle and saying something like, who you call in fringe. You know, how do you think that these people react to the perception of everybody else that they are marginal, maybe dysfunctional, mm-hmm. maybe misguided, maybe defective, you know, that there's something, that they're strange and that there's something wrong with them?
Well, certainly, you know, if you look at, like, the word cult, you know, you see that stigma that you think, okay, a cult, there's something wrong with them, as you just said. Now, technically, that's not the case. Cult is just kind of a size designation. It's like sect. It doesn't really mean that, even though it has, you know, it connotes that way in the language. I think a couple of groups that I looked at, the Christian Wrestling Federation or the Monks of New Skete, are examples of that. The latter, the monks, are an Orthodox monastery that's very well known for raising German Shepherd dogs. And so you say, well, how is an Orthodox monastery fringe? Well, I guess I included them because they're brand of orthodoxy is a little bit unusual in that they call themselves Orthodox Catholic, which is kind of a Christian oxymoron, and they are a little controversial within the Orthodox community. But also, they were willing to talk about how raising dogs informed their interpretation of Christianity. And they don't like getting pigeonholed as the dog monks because they've published a couple of famous books about it, and so that has tended to happen. But eventually, they did talk to me about that, and I thought it was really interesting, and it made them it didn't make them seem bad or wrong in the kind of stigmatized way of a cult, but it did make them unusual, and so perhaps fringe, and actually there, that was actually seemed to me to be a real comfort. I wasn't convinced or drawn in by any of these groups, but the life at the monastery more than the other groups, I could really feel the attractiveness of it. Beyond being able to portray it as a journalist, I could actually feel that one. I'll contrast that with, like, the Christian Wrestling Federation, which uses professional wrestling shows as a vehicle for bringing a new laity into the church. Now, they're part of the Baptist megachurch movement. They're closely associated with a megachurch, and that's mainstream, at least in the sense that they're large. Right? There's lots and lots of people. They're not small, like a cult or a sect. But within that, they're definitely fringe. Professional wrestling ministry seems very odd. So we of course that's fringe. And even within the megachurch movement, they were considered a parachurch. which is maybe a way of talking about the same thing, like parapsychology, parachurch. So it's maybe a way of another way of talking about what is fringe exactly.
Well, that's that group in particular. I can imagine some people quibbling with assigning that to the fringe category. As you say, on the one hand, it maybe seem a little odd that this is a group of Christians that are concerned about witnessing, as a lot of Christians are, and this idea that by putting on wrestling shows, they can somehow draw in people to Christianity that they wouldn't otherwise be exposed to it. Now, other than that, I don't know that in their Christian beliefs there's particularly anything non-mainstream about them. It's just that they've chosen this unusual way to proselytize, I guess, or to attempt to proselytize. And I'm sure that some people would say, well, that's really not, well, yes, it's a little on the odd side, but it's really not, you know, there's nothing non-standard about their beliefs.
Yeah, you know, there was one moment, you know, when I was at one of these wrestling shows. I mean, and the way it works is they put on a show, you know, and even normal wrestling, you know, even non-Christian professional wrestling has a kind of morality play quality to it. There's always like the clear villains and there's always the clear bad guys and the good guys always win. So the scholars who've looked at professional wrestling have generally come away and saying things like, gosh, this seems like religion to us. So it's not as crazy as an idea as you think. And after I started looking into it, it started to seem kind of inevitable. But what they do is they'll put on a show, you know, maybe in the middle of the show a couple of wrestlers will witness, as you're talking about, essentially tell their Christian story, and then at the end they'll essentially have one of the wrestlers will come out and deliver a kind of sermon, and so, you know, in one of those, the fellow who did that, you know, he said to the crowd, you know, he said, if you've never been to church ever, well, tonight you've been in church. And I thought, you know, there's that moment when you know, yes, they are their own thing, you know. And actually, I make the point in the book that if it was between the megachurch movement and the Christian wrestlers, William James probably would have sided with the Christian wrestlers because, again, the Baptist megachurch is sort of, you know, they're huge. They are an institution. That's the business of religion. Whereas the Christian wrestlers, they were more immediate. There was something about that experience that that worked for people. You know, that it had that cash value, that efficacy that James talks about. That was one of the things that I wanted to get at in that. You know, I'm not a person who can ever, you know, be brought into the church by a wrestling show. But I thought if I can describe what that show is like, you know, on the level of narrative and story, and show you as the reader, you know, maybe what's attractive about it to someone else, then, you know, you have done something. You have, you know, really gotten at something central about religion, if you can capture the essence of that experience in that way.
All right, let's talk with someone else here. We have someone listening and calling from Urbana, where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi. Several years ago, I sat in on a class where our teacher had a doctorate in psychology. It was a class about problems in home guidance of young children, and one thing she mentioned was our ideas of God are like our ideas of our parents. Does that seem related to some of your work and readings?
Well, it's certainly something that pops up, you know, a lot. You know, God is the Father, right? And and if you look at like some more fringe groups, like the Unification Church, that guy, his name is skipping my mind right now, but they call
Reverend
him
Moon.
I'm sorry,
Reverend Moon.
Yeah, right.
Sam Young Moon.
They're called the Parents, right? You know, and so that as a metaphor is pretty prominent in religion, and it was one of the things that I found it. The monks of New Ski, for example, had a different take on it, you know, and it was one of the ways in which you know, the dog training kind of informed their Christianity. They would talk about how a dog and a man's relationship is necessarily hierarchical. Right, the man is the master, and the dog is below the man. And the dog will attempt to sort of edge its way up in the pack, but the master asserts control over the dog, and that actually helps the dog become the most it can be. The dog is happiest when it understands its place in that relationship. And they likened this to, or at least they agreed when I likened this to the relationship between man and God. You know, that's necessarily hierarchical. And that embracing that hierarchy allows man to become the most that he can be, and so it's a contrast to kind of the standard parent metaphor. So I would agree with the caller at least in the sense that that's generally the way we think about our relationship with the divinity. But here's a group that has an alternate way of looking at it.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's talk with someone in Belgium, over by Danville, not too far away here, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, sirs. It seems the total basis of this conversation comes down to the basic fact of religion, that is, it's all based on faith. It seems that if the deity of any religion would show up on an annual basis and shake hands with the major prophet, religion wouldn't be very much of a religion. Everybody would believe in that one, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, you're making an important point, and one of the most fascinating things that I looked at when I started looking at it, one of the groups we haven't talked about yet is organized atheism, which is a group that I look at because most sociologists consider it to be a form of religion because it too is based on an unfalsifiable hypothesis. There is no God. You can't demonstrate that. So organized atheism gets classed in with religion. And what the surprising thing I found was is that the idea of faith is really relatively recent. Before, say, the 17th century, you had everybody had some kind of belief, and faith as an idea didn't really exist. There wasn't a difference between believers and non-believers. It was just a question of what you believed, and that's really fascinating to me that would be the case. As to the other part of what you're saying, I think I think were a deity to come down and shake hands with the prophet, everybody would be in line with that. That's not particularly likely, right? So what James is talking about, and one of the things that I wanted to get at and explore, was what do you do until then, when we have all these varieties of people, and we have all these varieties of religions, how do you make sense of that? And his solution was to say, well, maybe we shouldn't be talking about, you know, the fact of whether these things that people have faith in believe, maybe or whether they exist, I'm sorry. But maybe we should be talking about whether or not we can measure the efficacy of these ideas. And what he would say, you know, is that that yes, you can. You can look at a belief and you can measure it, you can observe it, you can be scientific in your evaluation of religion and its effectiveness outside a discussion of whether or not the object that is believed in truly exists.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Sure, thank you.
There, you touched on another point there. I think particularly if people, again, wanted to quibble, they would say you have in your book on religious experience included the organized atheists who don't believe in religion. That somehow doesn't – now, if you look at the general way that we've defined religion and its functions, then you could say, well, okay. I mean, if it's about giving meaning and structure to people's lives, well, then I suppose the campaign against religion could be just as meaningful and structure-giving as the campaign for some particular religion.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, I think we're kind of dancing around trying to define a religion, right? Which is what the scholarship of religion has always done, right? You really can't pin down an exact definition of what religion is, and atheism actually means, it doesn't mean a lack of religion. It means a lack of theistic belief, atheism, right? And the atheist I spoke with would be very specific about that. And something that's interesting within the atheist community now is that they're having this debate themselves as to whether they should acknowledge or consider themselves to be a form of religion. The ones I wrote about definitely did not want to, but there are others who do. But even the ones I did speak with would tell you, if when I asked them, well, why are you an atheist? And usually they would say, well, you know, it just came to me one day. and it's like that's a quality that you would have to say is part of how religion can or should be defined. Maybe it's not all of it, but that idea that you've tapped into some kind of truth is definitely part of religion, and again is something that you can look at in organized atheism outside a discussion of the whether or not there is actually a God, and if that winds up giving them community and direction and a sense that life has meaning, then certainly organized atheism has some characteristics of religions.
We have about 5 minutes left with J.C. Hallman, author of the book The Devil is a Gentleman, Exploring America's Religious Fringe. We have two calls. We probably won't. Well, now we have one. We'll try to get that one in. In Urbana, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I was hoping you could talk a little bit about why a person might be attracted to a fringe religion as opposed to a more conventional religion, or else even more of a fringe element of a conventional religion.
Sure.
I will hang up and listen offline.
Yeah, it's an excellent question. I'm glad the caller raised it. It was one of the things that I was thinking about as well.
You
could argue that conventional religion would provide all the same, would answer all the same needs that these would. So why would someone become a Druid when they could just as well become a Baptist?
Right. Well, it's a great question, and it's perfect because it lets me run the table of the book, because I can go directly to Satanism. Satanism is the only group we didn't really talk about. And, you know, what was interesting about Satanism is, first of all, they too are an atheistic group. The Church of Satan is the group I looked at, and they're atheistic. They don't believe in the God that they revere and to whom they pay tribute and perform worship services, etc. So again, you have a religion that sort of is acknowledging that they don't need to believe in the object that they're revering, and it still works for them. It still has an efficacy. But why would someone be attracted to Satanism? Well, Satanism is really interesting because it really can't exist outside of Christianity, right? Because Satan is the idea that comes from Christianity. And of course, it goes back further than that, because this really comes out of thinking about dualistic systems in general. You know, good versus evil comes from Zoroaster, Persia, and so what the Satanists would argue is that you have particularly in the West, you have a kind of structure to the world that causes a lot of people to be of one belief, you know, standard Judeo-Christian belief. But then there's always an other. There's always the thing that it needs to be fighting against. Good has always got to be fighting against evil, right? And somebody's got to be the evil, right? And so I think that Satanism resonates for people who feel left out. They can't resonate to Christian teachings, and whatever it is about society that makes that work for some people doesn't work for them. Right? Again, we're back to James saying there's a variety of people, there's a variety of religions. It makes sense. And so, Satanism then is almost a religion that's tailor-made for that, anticipating that some people are going to be kind of on the outside. And so Satanism is their way of taking that status and turning it to their advantage. And so Satanists would say, well, you know, if you Christians are afraid of this idea, then we will embrace that and we will use that to empower ourselves.
I'm sure that's the when people hear that you hang out with these various people, that it's always the Satanists that I'm sure people really want to hear about. They want to know, well, what are they like? What do they do? And you do talk a little bit about attending a satanic ritual. And the thing is, it just seemed, I no Satanists will hold this against me, it just seems a little silly.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, I think they know that. You know, I think that, you know, I did go to this satanic ritual, and again, it was like, you know, and I put this right next to the Christian wrestling match in the book, because I wanted to juxtapose those two things. And, but I think that the Satanists, they know that. You know, their rituals are at the same time that you sense that it's very serious. They seem to be very serious people to me. And they're very serious about their discipline. But at the same time, the rituals themselves were meant as satiric. It's a black mass. It's a satire of Catholicism. And so I think that they're aware of that, and they embrace that. And in doing that, I think they're kind of tapping into something pretty fundamental about the idea of ritual as well.
Well, we are unfortunately at the time. We will have to stop here for this hour. We've come to the end. The book is The Devil is a Gentleman, the subtitle Exploring America's Religious Fringe. The book is published by Random House by our guest J.C. Holman. He's a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and he is currently serving as the Bannister Writer-in-Residence at Sweetbriar College. Where is Sweetbriar College?
Sweetbriar College is in Virginia, just north of Lynchburg.
All right. Well, near Lynchburg, good place to be. Thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, David. It was a lot of fun.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archive. Other Focus interviews, along with shows from the Afternoon Magazine, in fact, all of our local production, is available for you to listen to anytime you like. It's at WILL.UIUC.EDU. In hour number two, we'll have another show from the Archive, so we hope that you will stay with us. Coming up in just a moment, we'll have news, so please stay tuned.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, offering licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork Associates has opened a new office inside the Oasis Center in the Illini Union.
Agricultural information on AM 580 is made possible with support from Lincoln Land Agri Energy in Palestine, Illinois, producing a renewable fuel with corn bought directly from the farmer. More information at 800-586-2321 or online at lincolnlandagrienergy.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. Corn gapped lower on the open for the second time this week. Along the way, it blew through the June low at 232 and a quarter. It also went through the January low this morning, that at 231 and a quarter. It appears headed for the December 12th low at 226 and a quarter, currently at 227 and a half. New contract lows also today. In soybeans, both in the September and November contracts, significant volume today as well. And it looks like the trade doesn't quite believe USDA's estimate for the soybean crop. They came out this morning with a number that showed a yield of 39.6. And that, of course, says August 1st, and the trade not believing the number. They think good rains since has significantly improved soybean yields. Let's go ahead and look at the current tick. And as we do, we see double-digit losses across much of the pit action today. In Kansas City, September wheat at 458, down 11 and a quarter at the board.